1 Samuel 21:1 through 22:5, the 16th talk in a series on 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on December 9, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship. Due to technical difficulties, there are 2 minutes missing from the middle of this recording. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to do chapter 21 and just the first part of chapter 22. Chapter 21 is short. I don't think it will take very long. And I've got more time than usual this morning, so there should be lots of time for questions and comments at the end. There wasn't any time last week, so I wanted to leave some extra. When we left off last week in chapter 20, David was running for his life. He's fleeing from Saul. It is clear that Saul has decided that he wants to put David to death. And he has his agents throughout his administration looking for David and looking for an opportunity to take him captive, arrest him. And at first, that was a secret operation that Saul was conducting, that there were only a few people within his administration that were trying to trap David. But now that's become a more general enterprise taken on by the administration. So David is in danger, and he previously, when he was in danger, he had gone to Ramah, where Samuel was, and sought sanctuary there, and God did deliver him from Saul and his agents at that time, but things are more dangerous now. David does not go there. David goes to a different village further away from Gibeah, where Saul is. He goes to Nob, which apparently was the site where the tabernacle was being kept at this time. So let's read the first section. Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" And David said to Ahimelech, the priest, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you.' And I have directed the young man to a certain place. Now, therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found." And the priest answered David and said, "There is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread. If only the young men have kept themselves from women." And David answered the priest and said to him, "Surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out with the vessels of the young men, and the vessels of the young men were holy, though it was an ordinary journey. How much more then today will their vessels be holy?" So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. David goes to Nob. He goes to the high priest. The high priest is Ahimelech. This is Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. We have earlier, we encountered another priest, Ahijah. We encountered him he was mentioned when it said that Saul was offering a sacrifice and he was consulting God as to whether he should attack the Philistines. And that was happening at the same time that Jonathan was going out to launch his little commando raid. So there is a Ahijah, a priest, who we have already encountered. That Ahijah was the son of Ahitub. So they could be the same person. The ending, Melech, means king, and Jah is short for Yahweh. So it would be in either, Ahimelech would be my brother, the king. Ahijah would be my brother, Yahweh. And there are instances where those are interchangeable, that sometimes the name shows up with Melech as the ending and sometimes with Jah as the ending. So this could be the same priest. It's either the same priest or these are brothers, because they are both sons of Ahitub. In any case, Ahimelech is at Nob. He is apparently the high priest, and this is the person that David goes to. David has been to this, has gone to see this priest a number of times. As we will see later in, actually we'll see it in the next chapter, David has frequently gone to consult with the priests before going out to against the Philistines in battle. And Ahimelech is apparently the one that he has approached. So David and Ahimelech are well acquainted. They know each, they've seen each other frequently. It's not clear what the nature of their relationship is, but my guess is that since David goes to him in this time of trouble, that their relationship is a good one, that there's respect between them. And I think that we will see in the next chapter that that is the case. I think there's more evidence that that is the case. So David has gone to the high priest, Ahimelech, at Nob, and the high priest's response is to tremble. We've seen other people tremble. If you'll recall, when Samuel went to Bethlehem and met with the elders trembled. This trembling seems to occur whenever people are afraid that they're going to get in trouble with Saul. That David's presence here seems to be problematic because it has apparently become widely known that there is tension between Saul and David. And that tension has apparently increased. It's unlikely that Ahimelech knows about the most recent events that have just occurred in Gibeah, in which Saul has sent his agents out to get David. Maybe he knows, but he probably doesn't know yet. In any case, they can probably feel the tension rising. So when David comes to Ahimelech, especially under these circumstances, and Ahimelech notices that these are unusual circumstances, and these unusual circumstances are David has no entourage with him. Apparently, usually when he comes on official business, he would have some people that would come with him. And in this case, he doesn't have that. He doesn't have a weapon. He seems to be in a hurry. He seems to have left Gibeah in a hurry. All of these are trouble signs as far as Ahimelech is concerned. And so Ahimelech sees David coming and thinks, uh-oh, we've got trouble here. I don't want to get in the middle of it. So he says to David, why are you alone and no one with you? So that's the major warning sign that he sees that's unusual, as David's there all by himself. And David's response is, I've been sent on this special mission by the king. I'm here because the king has sent me. This is a special secret mission. It's very urgent, so I had to just dash down here. And he asks then, do you have any food? I just need some food. If you got any food at all, 5 loaves will do. Just 5 loaves of bread will do me. And Ahimelech's response is, we don't have any common, ordinary bread around. The only bread that we've got is the showbread. And the showbread is just being replaced. Now, the showbread is bread that was commanded in the Mosaic Law that every week on the Sabbath, 12 loaves of bread were to be baked. And those 12 loaves of bread were put out, I guess, on display for the entire week. Then at the end of the week, that bread would be eaten by the priests, and fresh bread would be baked and put in its place. That's called the showbread. Only the priests were allowed to eat this bread. So what Ahimelech is saying is, well, it just so happens that the only bread we have is the showbread, and apparently this is on the Sabbath, which could be another warning sign to Ahimelech that David is coming on the Sabbath. The only bread that we have is the showbread that's going to be taken away and replaced with fresh bread today. And that is of concern because only priests can eat it. David and his men don't qualify for this bread. But Ahimelech is apparently willing to bend the rules under the circumstances, and is willing to give the bread to David if they have kept themselves, if David and his men have kept themselves ceremonially clean. And there are a number of ways that one could be unclean, ceremonially unclean. For instance, if one, I don't know if you had to touch a dead body or see a dead body, but that would be one way that one could be unclean. There are a myriad of ways that one could become ceremonially unclean. One of the ways would be to have had sexual intercourse within the last, and I'm not sure what length of time it is. So that's what he says here is, if only the young men have kept themselves from women. So he wants to make sure that they aren't priests, but at least they need to be ceremonially clean. And this would be the most likely way in which they would have become unclean. And David's response is, surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out, and the vessels, and that means that can mean it's just the stuff. The stuff of the young men were holy. Though it was an ordinary journey, how much more then today will their vessels be holy? David's argument seems to be that any other time we have come down to inquire of God, it has been on an ordinary mission. And on those ordinary missions, we always came ceremonially clean. This is not an ordinary mission. So surely on this occasion, we would all be ceremonially clean. That seems to be his argument. So the priest gives him bread, apparently the five loaves that he had asked for. So that's the five of the 12. Apparently he doesn't have many men with him. Five loaves is not going to feed an army. So he apparently just has a handful of men with him. They apparently are not with him right here before the priest. He must have left them elsewhere. Okay, next section. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. And David said to Ahimelech, now is there not a spear or a sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent. Then the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there is no other except it here. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. Okay, the first part of this is this ominous observation that's just tucked in here, that one of Saul's servants, Doeg, was there. Doeg is apparently the head of Saul's shepherds. He is an Edomite. Saul had led his armies against Edom and had And it is possible that Doeg was taken captive and was made a servant of Saul's. But he has a fairly high-ranking position. So apparently he has gained the trust of Saul. He is so he's in a high-ranking spot. It's unclear why he's at Nob. It says that he was detained before the Lord. And it's not clear what that would mean. It could be that he is there and has to stay there for some ritualistic purpose. That is, maybe he's taken a vow and he has to be there for a period of time, or he's doing some kind of penance, has to be there for some time. It's not clear what it means that he was detained before the Lord. But it would appear that Doeg is someone who worships Yahweh, is someone who recognizes Yahweh as God. But he is here. He is one of Saul's servants. That this is just a kind of an ominous statement, and it becomes more significant in the next chapter. So David had asked Ahimelech for bread. Now he asks another request. He says, do you have any weapons? Do you have a spear or sword or anything? I had to leave in a big hurry. I am completely unarmed. I am in desperate need of weapons. And the priest says, well, the only thing we've got is Goliath's sword. Rhetorical comment. Just this happened, this happened, this happened. It was then not uncommon for accounts to be written of a king that drew upon the chronicles, and typically they would be highly editorialized, that the author would draw very selectively from the chronicles and then explain the significance of these various events. And oftentimes it would have a theological theme, that these events show that our God looked favorably on this and unfavorably on this, et cetera, et cetera. And the books of the Old Testament seem to follow that pattern, that the books of the Old Testament are those editorialized versions of the history of Judah and Israel, but they are based on these chronicle accounts. And those are the resources from which they're drawn, which indicates that the historicity of these books is likely to be quite good. And I'm reading a book by Kenneth Kitchen that I find very interesting. It's the name of the book is On the Reliability of the Old Testament. And he is going through, he started with the divided kingdom, and he goes through and talks about the chronology within the Old Testament, who are the kings of other lands, what are they doing, what are some of the customs that we see being presented here. And then he compares that with the extra-biblical data, so archaeological data, data from extra-biblical texts, et cetera, et cetera. And he's making the case that the historicity of the biblical accounts of the divided kingdom in particular is outstanding, truly outstanding. Then he talks about the exile period. There's just less information. It's harder to compare the biblical accounts with the external because we don't have as much to go on. And then he talks about the United Kingdom, so that during the times of Saul, David, and Solomon. And again, it's pretty good, but we don't have as much extra-biblical information to compare the biblical record with. So it's not as compelling there just because we don't have enough. But that's the nature of the argument that he's making, which is very refreshing because in archaeology today, the dominant perspective is the perspective of a school of thought which is called the minimalists, in which they are convinced that the Bible is not a reliably accurate historical document. There's another school of thought called the maximalists, who defend the historicity of the Bible. And this is the first thorough treatment that I have seen written by a maximalist who is trying, is laying out this evidence. And it's the most thorough presentation that I've seen. So I'm very impressed. But that's why I find that verse interesting. In any case, Gad tells him, leave, you need to get back, you need to go to Judah. You need to get out of wherever you are, whether it's Moab or whether he was in Philistia. But you need to leave. You need to no longer be out of the country. You need to be in the country. So he says, go to Judah. So he's forcing David to take risk. He's forcing David to go back where it's not comfortable. So David does so. And then we will pick up the rest of this chapter next week. I just have a few things that I want to comment on, and then I'll open it up for questions and your comments. One of the things that has been impressed upon me as I've been looking through, studying through this in preparation for talking here, is the extent to which David was in danger. It had never really caught my attention how dangerous things were for David. Saul had built up an administration, a respectable administrative structure for his state. He had control of the army. He had control of the bureaucracy. And he could use that for his purposes, which allowed him to bring a lot of pressure wherever he wanted to bring it if he was determined to do so. And this is an instance. He has decided to go after David, and he can bring all of the instruments of his governmental power to bear on David if he chooses to do so, and he apparently has chosen to do so. So that puts David in a very difficult situation. He is at risk anywhere in the area that Saul controls. And you can see that David feels that keenly. He's trying to get away. He's trying to find safety, and decides he can't even find it within the boundaries of Saul's control. There are 8 psalms that David wrote and that we know were written on the occasion of him fleeing from Saul. And all 8 of them are written praising God for God's provision of safety for David in this very dangerous time. So this was an event that was deeply impressed on David's consciousness. He feared for his life at every moment, and his fear was justified. He trusted that God would see him through it, but that nevertheless led him to take extreme measures, like even going to Gath and apparently being willing to be a mercenary for the king there. So we need to understand that everything David is doing in this section is being done under extreme duress, and we need to feel that duress as we read what's happening in order to understand what David's up to. But David is, I talked about this a little bit last week. David is apparently very slowly coming to the realization that he has been singled out for a very special role in God's history. And I think that he's coming to a realization that he is going to be the king of Israel. But I think that he's only coming to that very slowly, and I suspect he's going back and forth between thinking, yes, that's what's going to happen, and no, it doesn't look like that's what's going to happen because I'm about to get killed here. So he goes back and forth. But But I suspect he has kind of an underlying confidence that things are moving in that direction and gains more certainty as time goes on. Some of the clues, and I mentioned some of this last time, but the very earliest thing was his protection from the bear and the lion when he was a shepherd. He looked on that as God's protection of him, and that has some kind of significance. He was anointed by Samuel. It's not clear what he was anointed to. Samuel apparently didn't tell him what he was being anointed to, but he was anointed. So in some sense, he was being set aside for some special purpose for God. He was enabled to kill Goliath, a very significant feat. And not only kill Goliath, but do so on behalf of God. That's the way David saw it, and I think David understood it that way. It had a significance for him. Later, he becomes the armor bearer for Saul. So he has been placed in a high-ranking position within Saul's administration. Not only that, he marries Saul's daughter. So now he has a legitimate claim to the throne. And then we saw in the last chapter that Jonathan seems to have come to the conclusion that David is going to become king. Just bring to your attention from the last section in chapter 20. Jonathan says to David in verse 13, the last part of verse 13. Well, I'll read all of 13. If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. Well, what does he mean, may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father? I think that's suggestive of Jonathan's realization that David has been given the spirit that was taken away from Saul. That is, a spirit that allows him to have authority as king. So I think Jonathan has come to the perspective that David is going to be the next king. There are other indications that Saul sees David as a threat to becoming a king, and even uses that as leverage to try to get Jonathan on his side. But Jonathan is unwilling. And David has become very popular with the people. So all of these things, I think, combined are giving David this sense, this growing sense, that he has this kind of destiny in front of him. And I think this chapter just adds to that. He goes to get some bread. He asks for bread. He asks for ordinary bread. And he gets bread that is reserved only for the priests. He asks for some kind of weapon. And he gets the most significant weapon probably in all of Israel, and that's Goliath's sword. So he asks for the ordinary, and he's given the extraordinary. Not only that, but when he goes to, I'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so David has this growing sense that, I think, that he is destined to become the king of Israel. Now, this becomes significant in the statement that David makes to the priest. He says to the priest, in explaining why he's there, he says, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you.'" Now, is this an out-and-out lie that David is saying here? On the face of it, it looks like that is the case. Saul did not send him on a secret mission. And so on the face of it, it appears as though this is just an out-and-out falsehood. Furthermore, if this is a falsehood, is it also a falsehood that there are other men that there are other men that are with him that he left someplace else? Is it also a falsehood that he and his men are clean? And it gets tricky here thinking about this. And I don't know the answers to those questions, but let me make some comments just on lying in general, and then I think there's a way of understanding what David has said here that is not an out-and-out lie. This issue of lying, is lying wrong? I find that a difficult issue. It is the case that if truth is not taken seriously, then it makes it very difficult for us to trust one another in what we say in general. So if David was lying with respect to the special mission, it does call into question other things that he is saying and whether those are true. And it kind of snowballs. That it is important for us as human beings to value what is true. But there are situations, and I'm sure you've all thought about these and heard these kinds of things before. There are situations in which saying something that is not absolutely accurate is probably in order. You've probably all heard the kind of scenario like in Nazi Germany. You have Jews hidden in your house. The Nazis come to the door, knocking at the door, and they say, "Do you have any Jews here?" And if you say yes, you are condemning those Jews to death. If you say no, you have told something that is not true. Is it wrong to say no, there are no Jews here? And I think the answer to that is no, it's not wrong. That there are times when lying is justifiable. You think of other kinds of scenarios, like your child has just created his first art masterpiece and says, "Isn't this good, Papa?" And it's scribbling. Can you say yes? I think clearly you can. I don't know where to draw the line in what kinds of situations lying is wrong. It's hard for me to figure out the definition, how to describe that dividing line. I think there is one. It's hard to know how to describe that. But I think it is clear that when we make any comment, we're making comments into a context, and that those comments, the context has to be taken into account in what kinds of comments should be made and how they should be made. So the same statement describing the same thing could be a lie in one situation and not a lie, and could be right in one situation and wrong in another situation. So we can talk about this more later. I don't know exactly where to draw that line, but I don't think that saying something that is on its face false is always wrong. God is concerned with our love for truth, not necessarily our love for facts. But I will bring to your attention, a lie was told in the last chapter. Remember, David wanted to find out whether Saul was determined to come and kill him. And so he told Jonathan that at the New Moon Festival, I will be expected to be there. Tell Saul that I went down to Bethlehem to offer sacrifices. David was not going down to Bethlehem to offer sacrifices. That was not true. And Jonathan did just as David had asked him to do. So Jonathan told something that was not true. And I think the author intends us to see that as a justified thing that Jonathan said. this is akin to the Nazis coming to the door and asking if you have any Jews hidden here. But I think that there is a sense in which what David is saying in chapter 21 is not contrary to facts. When he says that the king has commissioned me with a matter, the question is, what king? He doesn't say Saul has commissioned me with a matter. And there are, I think, indications here that David sees this as a higher calling. What he is doing in running away from Saul is indeed a special mission that he is being sent on. And the special mission, I think, is that he will go out and save himself and begin making progress towards becoming the king that he is destined to be. So what he says with respect to the young men, when the priests ask, have they been kept holy? Well, David is seeing this as a more holy mission than he has gone out on before. Why is this a more holy mission? He could have just said, they've been kept clean. He doesn't just say, they've been kept clean. He says, no, this is a more holy mission than before. I think that's significant. I think David actually sees this as a more holy mission. So I think that there are suggestions here that David is coming to a new realization, that what's happening here is David is coming to realize that his destiny is to be king, and the steps that he is taking are actually moving him in that direction. Some way, somehow, they're moving him in that direction. And his fleeing from Saul at this particular point in time, he didn't choose to do it. He's forced into it. And he runs away. And he doesn't ask for the showbread. He doesn't ask for Goliath's sword. He asks for ordinary bread. He asks for a weapon. And he's given consecrated bread, and he's given Goliath's sword. David isn't ambitious here, but at every turn, there are indications that there is something special about what is being done here and the role that David is going to play. So I think that there is a sense in which, and there's one other thing I want to say in that respect. In David's growing awareness, I think, that he will be king, then when he hears the comments in Gath of the servants who say, "Is this not David, the king of the land?" That's an interesting mistake for them to make. And I think David sees that as an interesting mistake. So verse 12, it says, "And David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath." So two things are happening. On the one hand, I think it's these words that they mistook him for the king. He's taking that to heart. That seems to be significant to him. But on the other hand, he's in a desperate situation, and he's fearing the king of Gath. That seems to characterize his progress through this whole section. On the one hand, it seems to be more and more clear that God has something special for him, that he's going to be king. But on the other hand, he is in truly desperate circumstances. So there's a sense in which I think it's possible that what David actually intended here was something that was very, he had a different meaning that was hidden behind his words. Did he mean it to be deceptive? Absolutely. So even if it's not a lie, absolutely he was trying to deceive. Was David doing right by deceiving Ahimelech? Well, we'll talk about this more later. What happens here is going to result in the deaths of tens of people. It's going to result in the deaths of a whole bunch of people in the village of Nob, all of the priests and apparently some others. So it has huge consequences. But I don't think that David is going to be seen as having done wrong in what he says to the priest. But we can talk about that more next week. Okay. Comments, questions on either last week or this week?
The older I get, the more I find myself seeing things like you're seeing lying, which is, when I was younger, I thought there was a whole lot more stuff, that ethics was a whole lot easier, that there were rules that you could say, you know, lying is always wrong, and this is always wrong, and that's always right, that kind of thing. And I wouldn't say at this point that there's nothing that falls in that category, but there's a whole lot less in my mind that falls in that category. So one of the things that's that is uncertain for me right now is the saying, you know, the ends don't justify the means. Mm-hmm. And at this point, the way I think about that is, if something is truly bad in itself, I think philosophically it's malum in se. If something is always bad, you should never do it in order to achieve some other goal. Now my question is, I don't know if there is anything that's malum in se. Maybe rebellion against God is always wrong. That sounds like a good candidate. Mm-hmm. What? I guess that's one of the things that bothers me about this situation is I do think you can draw a line between when it's. It's. I don't think that lying is malum in se, but I do think there is a line. There are some lies that ought not be told. So, what I'm trying to figure out is, if you're in a situation where it looks like you have to do something that, under other circumstances, you would not do, truth is important. So, if there is nothing at stake, why would you tell a lie? Of course you'd tell the truth. So what do I do? How do I decide when something's at stake there? When people talk about lying being wrong, very often the story of Corrie Ten Boom comes up where she's hiding Jews and she believes lying is malum in se. And they come up and they say, do you have any Jews? And she's so freaked out, she just starts laughing out of just sheer stress. And the guards interpret that as, or the Nazis interpret that as, oh, how silly. Obviously, I wouldn't be, why would I be hiding Jews? And they go away. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of how God will make his will happen no matter what. And so I can think anything that comes up, I can think if God doesn't want this to happen, it won't happen. It won't really matter what I do. So it doesn't really matter whether I come to the correct conclusion as to, is this one of those times when I should lie or one of those times when I shouldn't lie? So how do you balance? I mean, it is true that God will not let anything happen that he doesn't want to happen. On the other hand, there's certain ways that God likes to work, and as a student and servant of my master, I should be thinking about how does he like to work and sort of act consistently with that. So do you have sort of an approach that you take when you're trying to make an ethical decision where it looks like, is this an ends justify the, you know, do the ends justify the means in this situation? Is this something that's morally neutral? That the badness or goodness of it inheres from the context, such as lying. What are you trying to achieve? That mm-hmm. kind of thing. Or how do you approach that kind of situation?
Yeah. I'm not sure how I approach this kind of situation. I really resonate with what you said about over time, you have come to the realization that things are not as black and white as you used to, that there's a lot more gray. That's certainly been my experience, that life is really complicated. When I was younger, it was easier to say that action is wrong. And usually it was when other people did something, that action, that is just a wrong action. It is more difficult as I gain more experience and think more about life. It's more difficult to do that because life is so complicated. But one of the things that I have come to realize is that what we are called upon to do, what God calls us to do, what is right and wrong, is in a hierarchical structure. There are some goods that are more important than other goods, such that acting on any of the commandments we see in the Bible is always situational. That is, it is always that action in that particular set of circumstances is what has to be analyzed. You cannot really analyze a situation in the abstract because you need more information. Because that same action in one context could be right and in another context be wrong. It depends on all of the other circumstances. And it depends on whether a higher good is jeopardized. And so our job as students of God and His creation is to try to understand as clearly as we can what is that hierarchy of goods. And that's a difficult thing to piece together. But something like loving God comes above the safety of my son for Abraham. That there are goods that are just higher than other goods, and we need to reconstruct that and then operate according to it. Now, I'm not sure exactly how to think about David's situation, but I think there is a higher good here that would be jeopardized by him saying, being explicit and clear about why he's there and what he's up to. But those situations are, not only is it difficult to put together that hierarchy, it's difficult to analyze any given situation, even if you know the hierarchy. So it's doubly difficult.
David, on that, that 1 Chronicles 29:29, that mm-hmm. verse that intrigued you, it made me think back to when was the other time of prophets intervening in David's life, and there may be more before this, but it was back in 1 Samuel 17 when Samuel mm-hmm. is told to go and anoint him. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember because it's been a while now. He's told by God that yes. he's going. So do you think Samuel kept that to himself, or do you think that perhaps the prophets, because they're strung together in 1 Chronicles, Samuel, Nathan, and uh-huh. Could they be talking? Is this could be how the Philistines were recognizing him as king? Do you think this was kept quiet? I've forgotten what comes in between here, and maybe there isn't anything.
Well, my understanding is that Samuel kept that secret, at least initially, because if word got out of that, a word of that had gotten to Saul, Saul would have killed David for sure early on. So I think Samuel kept that secret. At some point, does Samuel tell others? It could be. That I don't know. And at what point? But I think that he would be very careful with that piece of information up at least until this point, because it could have put David in jeopardy. Now he probably can't be put in any more jeopardy than he already is. So it's possible that Samuel would make it more widely known. But I'm just guessing, but it just seems to me that it would be unlikely that Samuel would have made that widely known, widely enough known that word would have gotten to the Philistines.
So two more questions related to that. Then, when he's anointed in his home before the whole thing with Goliath, what is he thinking is happening to him? Is his family there? Because I went back and reread it, and it's kind of unclear.
What would
he be thinking is happening to him?
Well, I assume that his family knows that he's anointed. It's not clear whether the elders know, but his family appears to know that he's been anointed. But anointing, my understanding of anointing is it means that one has been set aside for a special purpose by God. It doesn't indicate clearly what that purpose would be. There are other anointings. So I think he's just left with this kind of vague, there's something special that's set aside for you. We'll just have to see what that is.
And then he slays Goliath, so he could have easily thought.
It could have been that. It could have been that, right.
As far as he takes it. Okay.
Right.
And then Gad is there beside him. So Gad is, do you think Gad knows, right here in this one we did today, he's by his side. You said that they were there chronicling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that by this time Gad knows? I know you can only speculate, but.
I don't know. My assumption is that what he has told David to go into Judah is not based on Gad thinking, well, he's supposed to be king. He needs to get back in Judah. My assumption is that it is actually some kind of commandment from God that's being passed on. I don't know if that's the case, but that's what I'm assuming. So I don't know how much Gad actually knows with respect to what that anointing was. That's one of the things that it is truly frustrating in these narratives, that there are so many details that we aren't told. And what it does, when you don't have the details, as a reader, you can't help but have your mind go all over the place trying to figure out, okay, what's happening here and how do we piece this all together? And sometimes that searching around for putting pieces together is very productive. That you can put some pieces together and a picture emerges that would not emerge if you weren't thinking hard about it. There are other times, like one of the things that I just kept going over is what happened to Goliath's sword? Did he take it into Gath with him? Because if he did, that's trouble. I mean, they're going to recognize it. That's all kinds of trouble. So he must have left it someplace else. But why does it even mention the sword if it isn't going to tell us anything more about it? And all I can guess is it wanted to tell us about it in that particular spot because it was important that was given to David. It's not important what happens to the sword afterwards. That's all I can figure. But you never know whether those kinds of issues are worth really pondering over until you've taken it to a dead end to see whether it turns up anything useful, because sometimes it does.
I have just a quick question. The way that you describe lying or the truth and not the truth really boils down to situational ethics. And I don't know if you mean it that way. That's part of my question. Mm-hmm. Because if you are weighing between one and the other and kind of not really sure when the truth is appropriate, it really does boil down, in my mind, to situational ethics. on the other hand, if as lovers of the truth, we understand that the truth is always the right thing, but because we are sinful and we can't really see the actions of God and his purposes, we lie. I mean, I lie. I know that I do, and the Holy Spirit reminds me, you know, that I'm not telling the truth sometimes, like when I say, oh, yeah, that's a great drawing. My grandchildren say, do something. Would it be okay to say that the truth is always right? How, if David had told the truth about the king, or told him why he was there, could it not have been in God's purpose to show David his glory and say, in allowing that priest to give him the bread anyway? Instead, it cost those priests their lives because of David's lie.
Right.
So I see it a little differently in that if we love the truth and we always know that the truth is right as Christians and we are all following the truth, is it really ever okay to say that a lie is okay or that a lie is the right thing? Is that making it situational ethics?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me talk first about situational ethics. My understanding, the phrase situational ethics came into vogue in, I think, the 70s, and it was used as kind of a strategy to clarify ethics, and you give a certain situation, and what would you do if you were in a boat and it was going to go down, everybody's going to drown unless you threw somebody out, and who would you throw out, and that kind of thing. Real life situations. But the general thrust of that was to show that there is no absolute standard for good and right, or for good and wrong. I think that there is an absolute standard for right and wrong, but it is a hierarchical standard. That is to say, some things take precedence over other things. And so the same action in one set of circumstances may be wrong, but in another set of circumstances might be right, depending on what hierarchy of goods come together in the different situations. Let me use an example that I've used before in other contexts, but it's easy because I've used it before. I can have for my children a rule that you never swing a baseball bat in the house. And if they were to do that, under normal circumstances, they would be punished. But if there's a fire in the house, and they have to get out quickly, and they take a baseball bat and they break the window so they can get out, I'm not going to punish them for that. Because a higher good kicks in there that takes precedence over other situations. So just as we as parents have a hierarchy of goods, God has a hierarchy of goods. That is, to my understanding, a set hierarchy of goods. So there's a sense in which it's absolute. But how it applies to different circumstances will vary depending on the confluence of goods, things that are at stake in that particular situation. I am not advocating situational ethics in the sense that I'm advocating an arbitrariness with respect to what is right and wrong. I don't think that's true. There is a fixed standard, but it's hierarchical. So what is good has to be determined with respect to the context in which it is. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying?
It makes sense in a way, and I understand the way that you're explaining it.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, it still boils down to if a situation, and the situation you're talking about with a baseball bat,
yeah,
is, of course, you'd want your children to save right. their lives by right. whatever means right. that they could, and you certainly wouldn't punish them for that. But what I'm talking about is lying. If your child lies to you, say for instance, they're protecting themselves from something, they're protecting a friend from something, they know that, for instance, a parent is a cruel parent,
mm-hmm.
and if I don't lie,
mm-hmm.
I'm liable to get beat to death.
Right.
Is it right to lie? Well, no, it's not right to lie, even to that parent. It's still not right to lie. It may be that God is intervening in such a way as to give you enough imagination to lie about something. I don't know, but it's the lie is not right. And we as people can see that if that child didn't lie, they would get beaten. But it still doesn't make the lie right. It makes it, you know, protective. It makes it makes your life go a certain way. It doesn't make that lie right. That's kind of what I'm saying. I'm not saying that there's never a right situation where, you know, where you're frightened or whatever, that you couldn't. A lie is a forgivable thing. If I lie, will the Lord forgive me? Of course. I mean, it's not that I'll go into a situation intending to lie. But to say that that lie is right, I'm not sure. And I don't know that saying that God's goods can be hierarchical. In my mind, they're all good. I mean, God's law and his standard is one hierarchy. He is pure and holy and good and what I should be striving for. But I'm still really kind of confused in my mind. I think you're making a good point, because we as human beings are sinful, and we don't know how to do the truth all of the time.
Right. I think this stuff is all extremely difficult. And I think in the past I would have taken the same position that you're taking. But I'm inclined to think now that under certain circumstances, just like using the baseball bat to break the window, it is actually right in that situation, that there are certain circumstances in which it would be actually right. They are unusual circumstances, such that as a general rule you can say don't lie. Just as a general rule in our household, you don't swing the baseball bat in the house. But that's all understood in the context that there is a hierarchy of values, and there are times when it would be appropriate to violate that general commandment. With respect to the showbread, here is another situation in which the priest is seeing this hierarchically. There is a hierarchy of goods. That generally speaking, the showbread is only to be eaten by priests. But here is a situation in which there is some higher good that's important here, and we'll make an exception. And Jesus later on is going to refer back to this approvingly. So Jesus is apparently seeing it as a hierarchy of goods as well.
Hey, David. My question is a little bit like my wife's, that hierarchy of good. What I've seen in most in situation, I don't like the word situation ethics, but the command not to kill, not to lie or steal. You could say, I need to steal because we are starving and my family is dying. I need to kill because somebody is evil going to kill my family if I don't kill them as a war. My question is, it seems like this, the higher command is always to preserve and protect the preservation of life that God has given. To me, that is the hierarchy. And in this situation, that's what David is proving.
And that's what I'm saying. I think putting together that hierarchy is a difficult thing. And there are lots of nuances to that, and exactly what goods are higher in and what way are they higher and that sort of thing is a very complicated thing to put together. And in that sense, I agree with you completely. We need to stop. We're already 5 minutes over.
Can I?
Sure, give an answer.
To what you're saying, I think we're possibly given the hierarchy here in that David, in the next chapter, it's clear that whether it's intentional or not, he's given cover to Ahimelech, because when Saul calls Ahimelech before him, he says, "You conspired," and Ahimelech says, "What do you mean? This is the trusted man. You sent him to me." So David has given Ahimelech cover for protection by this lie. So it seems like there's the hierarchy of the better good. He's protecting,
right?
Potentially protecting him.
We will be talking about that more next week. Thanks.